This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Roasted turkey with chestnut stuffing, mashed potatoes with homemade gravy, sugar cookies and hot chocolate with whipped cream. Am I making you hungry? What if I say donuts for Homer Simpson? Yeah. You already know that thinking about food can whet your appetite. I'll bet you're salivating right now. But did you know that you can also think your way into being satisfied? Using M&Ms and cheese cubes, researchers at Carnegie Mellon discovered that by imagining eating a lot of something, your mind subconsciously limits what you later put into your mouth. Joining me now to talk more about it is Carrie Moorwedge. He is Assistant Professor of Social and Decision Sciences at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Here from that sidewalk is welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this experiment, your study, where you had people imagining they were actually eating something.
Right. So let me walk you through what participants experienced. So imagine you're a participant in the experiment. You would come to the basement in Carnegie Mellon University.
Right.
You'd walk into our laboratory,
right,
where you'd see a number of computers in different cubicles. And you would be sat down and you'd be told that you're going to participate in an experiment on imagination and perception.
Right.
And we told people this because we didn't want them to know that we're going to measure their eating.
Mm-hmm.
So what would happen next is you'd be asked to imagine performing a number of repetitive tasks. And then you'd be asked to estimate the size of the things that you imagined. And then afterwards, we gave people some food to eat. And what we manipulated was whether people imagined eating 3 or 30 units of a food, such as M&Ms or cheddar cheese cubes, or if people imagined eating a different food or moving the food or doing something.
So those were really the controls that they didn't know they were.
Exactly.
Yeah. But the real idea was to see if they imagined eating that food first, if they would eat less of the food.
Right. And so we found that people who imagined eating 30 M&Ms instead of 3 or 30 cheese cubes instead of 3 afterward ate less from a bowl containing 40 grams of cheese cubes or M&Ms. And in this case, it seemed that only imagining the consumption of the specific food reduced their actual consumption later on.
Did it have to be the consumption of the same food?
Right. So in one study, we had participants imagine eating 3 or 30 cheese cubes,
right,
or imagine eating 3 or 30 M&Ms. And right, then we gave them a bowl filled with 40 grams of cheddar cheese. And there we found only people who imagined eating cheese were affected by this induction. So when people imagined eating M&Ms, it didn't matter whether they ate or imagined eating 3 or 30,
right,
they showed no difference.
Did they have to actually think about the food in their mouths when they were doing that?
Well, we didn't instruct participants to imagine chewing, biting, or swallowing.
Right.
But we did do one study that may address your question. So in this study we were worried that maybe people just thinking about food more generally might lead people to reduce their consumption. Maybe you just feel full, or
yeah,
maybe you're disgusted by the thought of the 30th M&M when you see it on the screen. Or
not
maybe
me.
maybe you're just bored. So
right,
so in these cases, what we wanted to do was we compared people who imagined eating 3 M&Ms or 30 M&Ms versus people who imagined moving 3 M&Ms or 30 M&Ms into a bowl. And what we found there was that when people imagined eating 30 M&Ms, they ate fewer M&Ms than people who imagined eating 3. But when people imagined moving M&Ms, we found the opposite effect. So people who imagined moving M&Ms, who imagined moving 30, ate
yeah,
more M&Ms than people who imagined eating 3.
So really was the imagining of the eating process that was important here. And why do you think that is? What is going on in our minds that just the imagining of it?
Well, that's a great question. So we think what the imagined consumption is doing is leading people to habituate to a food. And what I mean by habituation is it's a basic process that we see towards light, towards income, towards all these different kinds of stimuli. And it's basically people become less responsive to anything that they're exposed to repeatedly. So, for example, the 10th bite of pancake is much less desirable than the first. Or when you walk into a room, a really bright light might blind you at first, but then your eyes adapt to it.
Do you think this has practical values if you want to eat less, and could you extend it to other things we do? Like if you want to stop smoking, can you imagine you've had smoked a cigarette and not?
Well, that's a great question. We certainly think that it should extend to other kinds of stimuli. With extent to smoking, their addictive substances have a lot more complex kinds of psychological dynamics, and we don't really necessarily know whether it will extend to that. So I'd tell smokers to avoid trying this because we don't want to
get
them
you.
Even more addicted. but with regards to food, I think there's a few things that we want to test out first before we recommend this as a dieting technique. But it's certainly giving us some more insight into the kinds of things that make people stop eating unhealthy foods and might help them lead to make healthier food choices.
But what is there about, you know, we always heard that if you when you eat something, you feel sated because your stomach expands and things like that. But so you, are we getting then a phony signal to our food eating centers or something like
that? Oh, that's a great question. So a lot of the problem with relying on your sort of feeling of fullness is that it sort of unfolds much more slowly than your idea of sort of when you should stop eating. And there's been a lot of psychologists and food scientists and behavioral economists who've been doing a lot of research lately looking at the psychological processes that lead people to infer when they should stop eating. So people, everything from Brian Vonsink at Cornell, for example, has looked at some really interesting work on how different cues in our environment can lead us to feel like we should begin or end a meal. So
is that the famous soup plate, the soup bowl,
right?
The unending soup bowl experiment.
Right. So he's got this. he has people come into the laboratory, and there's you'd sit in front of a soup bowl, and he basically has it secretly hooked up to a 5-gallon jug, and as you're eating it, never goes down. So it's,
and people continue to eat it, right?
Right. I think they eat about 3 times as much soup as people who have a normal bowl.
So they're looking for that visual cue.
So in this case, they're looking right. They're looking for a visual cue, or if he manipulates the size of the plate. Mm-hmm. And there are other people who have been doing great work too, like Paul Rozin. He's a psychologist over at the University of Pennsylvania, and he brings amnesiacs into the laboratory, and he gives them lunch, and then he says thank you, cleans up, leaves the laboratory, and then comes back in a few minutes later once they've forgotten about their meal, and then gives them lunch, and they eat it. And then he leaves the room and repeats this process. And he finds that they tend to eat about 2.5 meals, whereas people with a normal memory would not. So people have been looking at this question from a lot of different perspectives. What's really exciting about this new research is that it's the first to show that just pure psychological processes can start this sort of process. And whereas in other cases, people were both exposed to the food that they imagined eating and people manipulated psychological processes, this research is really sort of showing us that just thinking alone can start these kinds of processes.
Now, this I'm tempted to say the placebo food effect on this sort of thing.
Right.
Could that be something like that involved? Some sort of placebo effect when you're thinking about eating and you say, well, I've already eaten.
It's a good question. And it'd be interesting to see sort of how this kind of research more generally could apply to placebo effects. But we do find that there's been a lot of research in neuroscience that has been mapping the connections between mental representations or thoughts of an event and the actual experience.
Right.
And there does seem to be a lot of overlap. So, for example, if you think about a spider crawling across your leg, you're going to find the same increase in heart rate and perspiration that you would if you were in the presence of an actual spider. And the most fascinating of these effects are mental practice effects. So sometimes people practice motor tasks, and then when you find that people mentally rehearse these tasks, their performance seems to improve.
Yeah, they envision how to be a better baseball player, tennis player, something like that. They envision the moves they're going to be doing.
Right, and this suggests that the same kinds of thoughts that we have about eating seem to be eliciting similar kinds of responses as actually eating itself.
In this day of brain scans and things, can you actually watch that now happen in the brain if somebody's not eating but thinking about it and see where all the connections are going?
Well, I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm a psychologist by training, but I'm certain that we could look at sort of what kinds of brain areas are involved in this process, and it'd be really exciting to do so.
But you're going to try to continue to measure psychological responses.
Right. So we have a couple of grants out right now where we're trying to look at sort of physiological effects of this kind of induction on salivation and other kinds of questions.
Well, there's the oldest one in the book, right? Salivation, Pavlov.
Yeah.
There was no food, but it was still salivating.
Yeah,
the dog.
Exactly.
So this is somewhere really hardwired into us, someplace, you think.
Well, the overlap between experience and our direct sensation seems to be quite. There seems to be a lot of overlap there, and it's an exciting new area that a lot of psychologists are exploring right now. Mm-hmm. It's certainly a hot topic of research.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to John in Anchorage. Hi, John.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there.
I have a question. I think a couple of years ago you had a guest on who had done a study where, say, they instead of eating chocolate, you just envisioned it, right? and you still had some of the same weight gain because it triggered chemical responses in the body. So without the benefit of eating, you actually suffered some of the consequences. If that's right, do you get some of the same thing from envisioning eating the M&Ms, eating fewer of them, that you still get some of the same body responses?
Thanks for the question, John.
Well, that's a great question. So we certainly didn't weigh our subjects before and after the experiments. So I can't answer your direct question in terms of that. But it would be interesting to look at sort of what are the long-term responses to these kinds of simulations. Certainly, people who have phobias, even though that they don't necessarily encounter the things that they fear, mm-hmm. their thoughts of the feared stimulus can affect their stress levels and their cortisol. So it's possible that there are long-term physiological effects to mm-hmm. just thinking about food as well. But
so there must be a product somewhere down the line in this sort of thing that you could maybe a weight loss product.
Well, my colleagues and I had a joke that if we ever had a diet book, it'd be a flip book, and you go to the page for the chapter for the food you were craving eating. But to be serious, we really don't know how long right. this effect will last. And one of the problems with using habituation as a dieting strategy be that people also show dishabituation. So if you give people something other than the thing that they've been habituated right. to, then it seems to undo the process.
Well, what about hypnosis? Could you give a hypnotic suggestion that when you look at a certain food, you feel like you've already eaten it?
Yeah. I can't answer that question, but it's a possibility.
But there hasn't been any research in that you know about.
Well, there's been research I know that looks at inducing hypnotic disgust, and that can influence people's judgments about how immoral or immoral a behavior has seems to them because it provokes a feeling of disgust. But mm-hmm. it's hard to say. There hasn't been a lot of good hypnosis research in this area.
It certainly looks like there's food for thought here.
Definitely.
Carrie, thank you for taking time to be with us, and we'll be right back. Carrie Morowidge is Assistant Professor of Social and Decision Sciences at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
And we'll come back, and we're going to switch gears, and when we do, we're going to talk about some famous men in the Royal Society and the 350th anniversary of that august body. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from NPR.